Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Happy New Year, everyone. Welcome to Boss Files. I'm Poppy Harlow. The first full week of 2020, a new decade, a presidential election ahead, and we're seeing more business leaders taking a stand on social issues, among them fashion designer Eileen Fisher. She sees her brand as a platform, and her employees are encouraging her to stand up on all sorts of issues, like climate change.
I think we're actually a platform. I think it's really, really important for businesses to speak to certain issues. In a different time, you would think the government would be holding those kinds of things, but it's a different time right now, so it's sort of requiring us to step up more.
She's a leading voice on environmental sustainability in the fashion industry, reselling and recycling garments in an effort to help curb climate change. The namesake brand has been impacted by the U.S.-China trade war, so we dive into that. She talks about having to rescale her production there. Also, and this is fascinating to me, her take on profit sharing. She owns 60% of her company. Her employees own the rest.
I think it's good for morale and for people feeling like they're really a part of this company, and people speak up more when they see things that don't feel right or people wasting money over there. They really feel it's theirs too. You know, they're a part of it.
Plus, her advice for all of us parents out there, what she wishes she'd done differently as a mother.
I think to put down the work. That's what I didn't do when my kids were young.
You work too much.
I work too much. I would bring the reports home or, you know, study things, think about things, you know.
Do you regret it?
I do.
And how Eileen Fisher uses meditation to guide her work and her life. What she learned from her own mother, who struggled with depression. So let's jump in right there with Eileen Fisher.
Good morning, Eileen.
Good morning, Poppy.
So my mom texted me last night
said,
you should wear your purple Eileen Fisher sweater that I bought you for the interview.
Oh.
I'm not. I'm sorry, Mom. It's in storage somewhere. I think she bought it for me when I was 18.
Oh.
But I still have it.
Sweet. That's
it's very a joy
sweet.
To be with you and to get to meet you after all these years of wearing your clothes.
Oh, I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
How would you define yourself, Eileen Fisher, today?
Oh.
Who are you?
Oh, me personally?
Yeah.
Who am I? Oh, my God. You didn't tell me you were going to start there.
Never do.
That's the hardest question of all. Oh, well, I'm a mom. I have two kids. I run a business. I'm a designer. I think I'm very grandly think I'm trying to change the world.
Well, just small goals.
Small goals.
For a Wednesday morning.
Okay.
You know, I read that I know that you don't call yourself a CEO.
Oh, right.
And you've been described as a reluctant leader.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Is that appropriate?
Yeah. Yeah. I do call myself co-CEO as of the last year, which is big. Was a big leap for me. But I think that I think the way I lead is I had this idea when I started 35 years ago. Actually, the idea came to me 40 years ago, and it was really, you know, just about simple, timeless clothes and how they went together, and, you know, good quality materials and no waste, things like that. And I think that I lead through just following this idea. And so I try to gather people into the idea, into what we're trying to do, and, you know, how we're trying to make getting dressed simple and comfortable and those kind of things.
And
which reminds me, I'm an uncomfortable person, which is often how I start.
That you're an uncomfortable person?
Uncomfortable person.
I think we're all uncomfortable.
No, not you. You are.
Of course I am.
Oh, really?
Like the hair and makeup and the confidence is a facade.
Of course I am.
Meditation. You do something that I dream about doing and haven't gotten there yet.
Oh.
But I'm 37. You didn't meditate at 37,
no,
did you?
No, let's see. When did I start? I started around 20 years ago and
right.
pretty, you know, committed about 15 years ago.
So I got a little time.
You got time.
But you meditate every morning. You did early this morning.
Yes.
But you still say, I still wake up every morning feeling crazy.
Really? Yeah, pretty stressed. Yeah. I know, that's crazy,
isn't it?
That's
just not how you come off.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad.
What are you stressed?
That's my facade.
What are you stressed about?
I'm stressed about my life, my son, my work, you know, what I'm trying to be and do, and whether I'm doing it well enough, and how it could be better, and all of those kinds of things. But once I start meditating, it's gone and I'm ready to go.
How long?
Until I come to like an interview or something like this where the stress comes up again.
And you don't love being in the public eye, but I thank you for doing it.
Yeah.
Because you are, you've described yourself as a shy extrovert. True?
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah.
But yet you have had through your life all of these grand goals and ambition and taken a lot of risks.
Yeah.
How have you overcome that desire to, you know, keep
to
inward and to sort of stay in a shell?
Yeah. Well, I think first I did it through the following the vision, the idea. So it was more about pictures and, you know, sort of following this thing rather than speaking. You know, so it didn't feel like risk. It felt like I was following something other than myself, like something that was coming to me or through me or something like that. So it never felt like a risk. It felt like, even all the way through, it always felt like I was just doing the next step, you know.
We'll get to the brand and how you built it in a moment.
Okay.
But I think to set up what you have built and the risks that you did take, let's talk about what it was like growing up for you. Because as I understand it, some of your earliest memories, especially of your mother, are sewing and making clothes.
That's right.
Can you take us into the household? What was it like?
Oh, well, the house is a little bit chaotic. Seven children.
Wow. Yeah. Mine's chaotic too.
So I know.
Seven.
I know. Mine too.
Imagine.
Mine is too. Yeah. But, you know, my mother, you know, she was cooking, cleaning, you know, all those kinds of things all the time, and even too busy to teach us for the most part to help her. So she kind of did it all. But she did love to sew. And she loved to go to fabric stores. She liked clothing. She, you know, so she would take me to fabric stores. She would make clothes for me. And I remember the first dress she made me. It was a little red shift dress. Uh-huh. It was wool, and it just had this little boat neck. It's a simple little red shift dress. And I was like in probably eighth grade or something like that. And I remember wearing it, like when I first started going to these dances, these little sock hops and things like that, where there were boys, and just like dancing in this simple dress. It was just so comfortable and so easy. And I sort of fell in love with kind of that, probably
14,
something like that.
Do you think that that was the inspiration for the brand you would eventually build?
Probably. I don't think I thought of that. I think the actual inspiration, my memory of it came when I was in Japan.
Sure.
You know, but I do think it was embedded.
That comfort of clothing and being yourself in this dress.
What I was looking for, and also that I wore a uniform. It's Catholic school, and so I wanted that kind of simplicity. I hated wearing a uniform, but I wanted the ease of just throwing on and go, worry about my clothes.
I mean, I spend time and energy thinking about what I'm going to wear and yearn for simplicity.
Right. But we want it to be fun, too, and we want it to, you know, feel good and look good and all those things.
You talk about your house, your childhood, being chaotic, that's the word you use. Can you tell me more about your mother and her struggles, especially because she had seven children?
I think she was just utterly overwhelmed. She just couldn't manage, you know. It's like, I just remember, you know, the bus coming down the block. She would be standing in the little tiny kitchen and making sandwiches. She had the bags all lined up, seven in a row, you know, and just like making the sandwiches
and
putting them in.
No.
And she just was so overwhelmed. She could, no help, no outside help, but she couldn't teach us. And if we tried to help, she couldn't make room for us.
That eventually spiraled into pretty severe depression.
Yeah. She landed in the hospital when I was 16. Yeah, that was...
Because she had a breakdown?
She had a breakdown, yeah.
Can you tell me, were you there?
Yeah.
And what did that do to you and your siblings? What was the impact on you?
Well, I think I just kind of went numb at first. You know, just I didn't know what to make of it. I didn't know how to help her. I didn't know what to make of it. And I just remember the thing that stands out in my mind is my dad talking about driving to work the next day after taking her to the hospital. And, you know, he said he broke down crying. He pulled over to the side of the road and said he had just been thinking the day before on his way to work that these were the happiest days of his life.
Wow. Because she would sort of put on her mask, if you will, at the end of the day.
Exactly. She would be chaotic, rushing around, you know, kind of screaming and yelling. We called it ranting and raving. Oh, Mom, my sweet mother. Oh, now I'm remembering the sweet parts of her, you know. So she wasn't, you know, oh, goodness, sorry.
That's okay. She wasn't perfect.
She wasn't perfect.
We are not.
And there were many sweet parts. And I got to sew with her. You know, I got inspired and...
Did she get to live to see what you built?
She saw enough of it.
Good.
She did.
Good.
Yeah, I think she was. I think she was amazed, and you know, I think, yeah.
Because she was not afforded the opportunity, or didn't think she had the opportunity to have a career.
Oh no. Yeah, I don't know why. I think she didn't think she had choices in her life.
I remember vividly Ruth Bader Ginsburg talking about her mother, Supreme Court Justice, and saying that a lot of what she has worked to achieve is because she saw her mother, who was very smart.
Right.
But just the time, society.
Right.
That her mother didn't have the opportunity to achieve those things.
That's right. Yeah. And I can relate to that. I can totally relate. I always felt like my mother didn't have her own money. She didn't feel like she could buy herself a dress, you know?
Right.
Yes, we did buy fabric and make some things, but I don't remember her ever making herself a dress.
Right, and that the inability to be financially independent is a reality for so many people and scary. Has that shaped how you think about money? I know you're a little bit uncomfortable.
What?
With money.
With money, I know, I am. Wow, actually, I lost the question you just said. That's obviously how uncomfortable I am.
did that shape at all sort of how you think about money?
Yes. I think that I knew that I wanted to be independent. I wanted to be able to make the choices I wanted to make. And whether that was buy a garment I wanted to buy or go to college, I put myself through school. My father didn't think that was necessary.
Your father did not think it was necessary?
For girls to go to college. He sat me down to say, well, it's great that you're going to college, but we don't have the money to support you to do that.
Did he think you should have a career?
He didn't think it was necessary. He said that you'll get married one day and your husband will support you.
Even after seeing what your mom went through?
Yeah. I just think that he saw the roles very clear.
But then fast forward a few decades, he comes to New York.
Yeah.
You're starting out. And he's looking.
He was blown away.
He's looking through your books, right? And what did he say?
He said, oh my God, Eileen, do you know how much money you made last year? And I said, no. And he sat back and he said, $200,000.
Wow.
That wasn't the profit. That was just the revenue at that point, you know.
Sure.
But that was enough for him, you know. He was just utterly stunned.
More from my conversation with fashion designer Eileen Fisher after the break.
Burger King. 15 years old.
Right.
I worked at a gas station.
Oh, you did?
I did.
Oh, that's
I made
great.
A lot of money. I made $13 an hour.
Wow.
Which,
I made 50 cents an hour, but that was a different time.
Yeah. But still, $13 an hour
when I was
that's like 24 years ago. That was a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
It was a Saturday morning, 7 to 3.
Wow.
I'm so glad I did. I owed my mom money. I had bought some clothes and spent money that she hadn't given me permission to. So she said, how are you going to pay me back? And I went and worked at a gas station and paid her back all $900. And then I kept working there. But how did Burger King at 15 shape you?
Well, first I got to buy contact lenses that in those days cost $200, and it took me several months to save the money to do that. But I think it gave me independence. You know, it gave me choices. You know, I worked at Burger King, and then I worked as a waitress, and I saved enough money to put myself through college. And I also think in terms of shaping me, I was very practical about money. And I think that I understand
the value.
I understand money. I understand the value of money.
Do you think that has stayed with you? Because it has stayed with me through my career. I still think about, do I really need to buy that coffee, or I'm going to bring my lunch to work, or just the practicality of it.
Yeah.
You still, despite all the money you've made.
Yeah. I had to be like, now I sometimes travel business class, first class, but I had to be really,
I think you
just sat down and talked into it, you know?
Yeah, just because it seemed frivolous?
Yeah. I was like, well, God, it's just a few hours. What difference does it make, you know? A little better food or food in general these days.
That's true. $350, is that what you started the brand
with? That's right.
How?
Yeah, I know, it's crazy. Like, I didn't, you know, I was a designer. I did graphics and interiors, but I didn't know anything about designing clothes, really, you know? Although I think design is design, and you can, you know, design a lot of different things, but I didn't understand the fashion business at all.
Right.
So I didn't even know you should do a fashion show if you're starting a line of clothing.
You don't do fashion shows.
No.
At all?
No.
Have you ever done New York or Paris Fashion
Week? No. We do Fashion Week in our way, in our showroom, and, you know, maybe
you
we'll
didn't
have...
Want
no, but
to.
Never... Never a runway show.
You didn't feel, you were just in Vogue a few weeks ago. You didn't feel like you needed Anna Wintour sitting on the sidelines?
She's terrific,
you know.
But I didn't think about it. I didn't know it worked that way, so I didn't know that that would be beneficial. So, but I was just at a meeting with her the other day, and it was about sustainability. So now
good.
That's a really
which we'll talk a
interesting.
Lot about.
Now we need her. That's great.
Well, because, and we'll get to that in a moment, but the fashion industry, clothing, excess clothing, is such a huge contributor to waste in this in this country and in this world. So $350 to start the brand, and the influence of Japan.
Yes, okay.
And the kimono.
Yeah.
Talk to me about how that all came together.
Yeah, well, it also comes back to my mother, because my mother saved every scrap of fabric when she would sew.
Oh,
so I was very interested in not wasting.
Sure.
So I was fascinated by the kimono when I was in Japan, because first of all, I liked the shape, you know, the simplicity of the shape and the movement but also the fact that they wore only that shape for over 1,000 years in Japan. I thought, what an interesting concept. You know, what a timeless idea, like of no waste, that you could wear, you know, keep using these things year after year, pass them down to the next generations. They have trunks full of their kimonos. And of course, now they wear Western clothes, you know. But, you know, for...
But timeless and classic.
Yeah.
Shape of the brand.
Yeah, definitely.
You make it to a trade show.
Yes. Okay, you're back in the early days again.
What
okay,
year is this, roughly, and what happened?
1984.
Okay.
Right.
So what happened?
The first show, I sell clothes. I stand there. I can't speak the first day because, you know, speaking is not what I do.
I'm a little nervous.
I make pictures and I...
Yes.
I was so nervous I couldn't speak. I just remember, and people would come by and ask me, you know, what does it cost? What are the style numbers? I'm like, oh, style numbers. Oh, could you come back tomorrow? Let me think about price, you know.
Really? You went into a trade show without thinking about price.
Which is crazy after Burger King and all of that, you know. So I understood about money. I knew that I wanted to sell clothes, you know.
Yeah.
But I just didn't know, you know, I just didn't know what to expect. And so, but, you know, I started talking to other designers and people there, and they helped me to figure out how to price the clothes and put style numbers on them and all that. And I sold a few, I sold I think 8 stores in my first show. And, you know, that was a great little start. And I was like, I felt like I was learning, I was understanding the business.
You have described in the past the women that wear Eileen Fisher as artists, therapists, and teachers.
Oh, yes. Okay.
And journalists.
Okay, right. Okay. It's broadened a lot.
My mom is a therapist, so there's that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that who wears Eileen Fisher?
Yeah. Well, I think it's broadened, you know, lots of women find the clothes. But I think it is something to do with the way that you kind of find yourself in them, that they don't sort of wear you, you know, they're, there's, it's, you know, I guess there's a certain style about them, but and I don't think one always will look at someone and say, that's an Eileen Fisher. Like today, people come to me and say, you know, I'm wearing your sweater, I'm wearing your pants, I'm wearing, you know.
They do? All that. You get stopped all the time in New York?
Yeah, but I do. More commonly, I give people my credit card and they go, do you know that there's a famous designer with the same name
as
you?
That's really funny.
I love that.
That's really funny.
No, but I think what I was saying is the point about the clothes. Like, I'll often not recognize someone wearing Eileen Fisher because they're so simple that they become you.
What is the key to, because if I can find that purple sweater, I bet it would look pretty similar to something that you would sell in this store
today.
How do you keep something timeless and relevant, especially in the age of fast fashion?
Right. Exactly.
And
that's
trends.
Good question. Yeah.
How do you do that?
Yeah. The first rule is keep it simple. And the second, I think, is good quality material. Not too, you know, like you want to move with the trend, you know. So if people are wearing skirts, or you know, if the sweaters are shorter or longer, or the necklines are changing, kind of move with that a little. Mm-hmm. But those kind of things are kind of they're kind of timeless. It's just how you put things together that allows you to shift things.
Have you? One thing I thought of as we were preparing for this interview is, if I can say this in a polite way, I hope it comes across that way.
Okay.
You are an older executive in the fashion industry.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, yes, yes.
And I kept thinking about, does she face ageism? We talk a lot about sexism.
Yeah.
Have you ever, I mean, you didn't take the company public, you don't have outside investors, you don't have to answer to them, but I just wonder if you've ever faced that in your life.
Personally, probably not. I would say not.
Good.
Personally, I'm sure that's a problem for women working.
It's a big problem, especially for mothers who try to get back into the workforce after taking a decade or so to be a parent.
Right.
They've many experience. People think, oh, well, you're not relevant.
Right.
And
right.
Where I mean, age is, I prefer my 30s to my 20s, and I hear my 40s will be better than my 30s, and I think with age comes experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's nice. I agree. And I also think we do wrestle with relevance in terms of our audience. We've built an audience that's loyal and grown with us, and reaching the next generation has been, work for us, and we're still working on it.
The millennials. You know. Do millennials, do you have data on millennials and if they...
Yeah, I mean, they're finding us. They're finding us.
The price point, you have a certain price point.
It's
expensive. High.
Yeah.
So that can be a barrier for some younger people, of course.
Yeah.
You do resell clothes.
We do resell.
We'll talk about.
Yeah.
For a lower price point. But what do you know about younger people in the brand?
Yeah, I know that they like our most simple pieces, the ones that they really look at and go like, oh, I'm just going to wear that black cashmere sweater every day. It's the perfect simple thing, you know. That's the kind of thing. They're almost more practical in some ways. So interesting.
So they'll make one sort of aspirational bigger purchase.
Yeah, yeah.
Coming up, Eileen Fisher's commitment to sustainable fashion.
Okay, let's talk about sustainability. So the data is scary.
Yeah,
I didn't realize
it's very
it until
scary.
We started preparing for this interview.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
The Council for Textile Recycling says this year, 2019, Americans will throw away more than 35 billion pounds of textiles. That's double what it was in 1999.
Yeah.
Greenhouse gas emissions in 2015 from textile production totaled $1.2 billion of CO2 equivalent.
Right.
More than all international flights and maritime shipping combined. You just met with Anna Wintour about this.
Yes.
Can you take us into the meeting a little bit?
Yes. Well, that's the Fair Fashion Institute that heads that meeting. Basically, the industry is really aware that, you know, this has to change. And there are lots of companies already doing lots of good work. I mean, we've been on it for many, many years. I mean, we, you know, it's sort of embedded in our way of being. But the industry is looking at everything, you know, looking at the starts with the raw materials. That's sort of the first agenda item of this group, because, you know, the fashion business is all about fabric, clothing, you know. So half of our impact on the environment is the materials, or actually 75% if you include the processing of the materials. So that's where we focus. That's where the industry is focused.
I don't think people know that, like, making jeans is really bad for the environment.
Yeah.
Or all of the places that a white t-shirt has to travel and the items before it's made.
Right.
So
the water use is stunning.
Stunning. You guys, as I understand it, did an internal audit of environmental practices at the company. What did you find?
Of our environmental practices?
Did you?
We are always doing that. We measure all the time. What did we find?
And when did it start?
Oh, we've been doing this for some time. We set what we called our Vision 2020 goals about 5 years ago, when we made a commitment that we wanted to be a 100% sustainable company, which, to be perfectly honest, we are not. And but we found, I think at that point, we started really, we'd already been looking at all of our raw materials and trying to redirect our processes to, you know, become more eco-preferred materials and things like that. And we found a lot of things, you know, everything we learned, we have a whole team that works on this every day. And so we're always, we know that things like organic cotton, you know, not using pesticides, that's huge. And only 1% of the cotton that is used is organic. So all of our cotton, like 98% or 99% is organic. That's just one material. But things like rayon, a lot of rayon comes from cellulose. A lot of it actually comes from the rainforest, from cutting down trees. So it's hard to trace. So we make a point that if we use rayon, which we are phasing out of, because even the processing of rayon is complicated and polluting.
What would, I'm making an assumption here, but I'm pretty sure it's right, that rayon is used all across, especially fast fashion, less expensive.
Yeah.
What would people need to know? How do they know that that's in their clothing? Is it labeled?
Yeah.
Is
Well, we label all of ours with fabric content.
Okay.
I'm not so sure if that's required. I think a lot of companies do.
All those companies want to sell more clothes.
You want
to sell less.
Well,
true?
We want to sell more of the good stuff.
Okay.
That's the plan. But yes, I think we want to encourage the customers to slow down, to be more mindful of their choices. And because actually that is the consumer, the consumerism, the mass consumerism is... It's not helping us either, you know. It's making our lives a little crazy, you know.
Well, I think we often think if I buy things, I'm going to be happier.
Right. That's
and
true,
you feel that sort of initial
kind
high.
Kind of like eating,
for like,
right?
Yeah. Yes. For like a day or two.
Yeah. Right.
Right? And that's why I think especially millennials value experience over anything.
That's interesting.
So because you don't want to sell just masses of items, what does that mean for your margins? How much higher do your margins have to be?
Well, I don't think that our margins have to be higher to sell less. I think it's an adjustment, I guess, in the business model. I'm just thinking. I don't know. It's not what we do, so I don't think about it as mass.
You've never thought about it that way.
It's not the way I think about it, right. So where am I going with this?
Well, you can think about it while I ask you about reselling items.
Yes, okay.
You collect, and you have for a while.
Yes,
items.
10 years we've taken back the clothes.
For 10 years?
Yeah.
From as long ago, Eileen Fisher, from whenever?
Well, we're 35 years old, so not from the very beginning,
I mean. Yeah.
But 10 years. Yeah.
What do you do with that?
Right, so we resell, as we clean and resell as much as we can, and so many of our stores have a section that has the recycled clothing available to the customers to buy. Then what we can't sell, we have a little factory up in Irvington. We call our tiny factory. It's not so tiny, 20,000 square feet.
Here in New York.
Here in New York, on the river, up on the river. And we remake the clothes. So, you know, I'm a big, like, problem solver. If there's a problem, you know, like the pollution problem, I'm like, let's dig in. You know, something positive is going to come of this. So what happened with us is that we were taking all these clothes back. And then we found that we were building up these piles of clothes that we couldn't resell.
Yeah.
And we were giving them to charity and things like that. Yeah. But it was just, then it was too much. We had three warehouses full of the clothes that we couldn't resell, but we couldn't put them in the landfill. So we started looking at what can we do with these clothes. And we started remaking them into sometimes clothes, but now we're also doing a line of, you know, like little pillows, and we have wall pieces, and we did a big show in Milan. Very exciting.
There's a cool machine.
Oh, yes, the felting machine.
Yes. And it's like you layer a bunch of pieces on top of one another.
Did you see that? You saw a video or something?
I did.
Yeah. Well, I have this wonderful woman, Siggy, who works. She was my very first employee. And she was the one who started the
recycle.
Yeah, she started the recycle program, but she's the one who found the felting mm-hmm. machine, which was never used for recycling in the way we're using it. I mean, people make insulation with these big felting machines, but
making pillows and tapestries.
We're doing a sort of an artisanal thing, and they're all one of a kind things, and they're just starting to be available in our stores, the pillows, and some of, in like five of our stores and online, you can see the pillows and the tiny bags, and we're getting there. It's exciting.
You have called the brand Eileen Fisher quadruple bottom line business.
Oh, yes.
What does
that
mean?
Right.
What are the four things?
Right. It means we measure our environmental impact, our social impact. So that's kind of our internal and external, so our employee well-being and also the well-being of the workers in the supply chain.
Right.
But also, of course, profit. I almost forgot that one. I was like, what's the fourth one? Profit. Right.
Yes. So let's talk about profit and profit sharing.
Yes.
Privately held still.
Yes.
ESOP,
I own 60%, and the employees own 40%.
How did that happen?
Yeah. There came a point once we started having extra profit, the first thought was share it with the employees. They do all the work, you know, and they, you know, it's only fair to share, which I think all companies should have to do.
I'm going to start, by the way, saying that to my kid. It's only fair to share.
It's only fair to share.
My three-year-old.
We just made that up. That's good.
All right, good. That's coming out tonight. Okay, so you said you think all companies should do this.
I think all companies should do that. That would help to level the playing field.
Progressive push for that
now,
you know.
Yeah.
So, but it's this is only after you decided not to go public?
Right. Well, first we were doing profit sharing before
that.
So that, as soon as there was extra profits, we started sharing the profits. Companies started wanting to buy the company, and I was like, well, that's not really what I wanted to
do. Who tried to buy you guys? You can tell me now, because it's, you know.
Well, in the old days, it was Liz Claiborne, and, you know, I don't really know who else, but lots of different people, you know. But I didn't really want to do that, and there was a moment we sort of entertained the idea of going public, and what would that mean? But, you know, I was told I didn't have an aggressive enough growth plan.
Who told you that? The guys in the room?
Yeah, I guess so. They were definitely guys. And I was like, aggressive. Well, I don't know. Maybe that's not the idea. I needed to be saying I was going to open 50 stores, you know, and I wasn't, or 100 stores, or 400 stores. But I didn't know whether I was always like step by step, you know. If I open one store and it works, we'll open four, and if the four work, we'll open eight or something like that, and we'll just see what happens.
And now you have 65.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Okay, so you said no.
So I said no to that.
No to those guys.
So we're getting to the ESOP idea.
No to the public market.
Right.
But then it was selling.
Right. And then it was, this idea came up because there was an idea that I should diversify my assets. But I didn't think so much of them as my assets. They were all in the company, everything. You know, I didn't have any private money that wasn't in the company. I think I owned an apartment, something like that at the time. So we somehow, it was probably through my CFO at the time, the idea that we could do this employee stock ownership idea. I was like, well, that sounds interesting. Let's explore that.
Yeah.
And so we worked on that, and I think I sold 30% to the employees, and the idea was we had to borrow the money from the bank, and then the bank paid me, and then the employees got shares, and we got a big tax deduction. So it was kind of win-win-win.
So talking about your belief that all companies should do this today and the sort of progressive movement behind that.
Yeah.
What should that look like for, say, a Walmart or a Target or some of these other big retail companies?
Well,
What would you do if you were running them? Because they do have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholder.
I know.
And they have to answer quarterly to the public markets.
Right. I know. Yeah, I think, well, it's a tough one. I think they should do it anyway, because I think even 10% of the profits is, I think it's good for morale and for people feeling like they're really part of this company, and people speak up more when they see things that don't feel right, or people wasting money over there. They really feel it's theirs too, you know, they're a part of it. So I think there's a lot of benefit by doing it. Besides being the right thing to do.
Do your employees speak up and say, we don't want you using our money that way?
They do, yeah. Yeah, as an owner, I think, you know, maybe we shouldn't be doing that. Or, you know, we should change this. Or, you know, a lot of comments. Good.
And has it changed your behavior and decision making?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. I listen. I always think that that's the way I try to lead, as we were talking about in the earlier part of the interview. I listen to everybody. I love to hear what people are feeling and thinking, and that influences where we turn the company, what we do, and, you know, so it's a...
Elizabeth Warren, Senator Elizabeth Warren running for president.
Yes.
And Bernie Sanders both support plans that would essentially force corporations to have 40% of their board be made up of employees.
40% of the board made up of employees. Oh, that's interesting.
Good idea.
Oh, I don't know. We actually don't have employees on our board. We just formed a board about a year ago, so we're still trying to figure out how do we do this. And, well, you know, but that's come up, that idea of employees on the board. And, well, it's something to think about. I don't know about 40%. I don't know. But that's definitely a suggestion.
Food for thought.
Yeah.
Amazon. Is Amazon a threat or opportunity for you guys? Because, as you know, they're getting increasingly into the fashion business.
Yeah. Yeah, that's making me uncomfortable.
It's
a threat.
The question
it could
or
be
Amazon?
A threat, you know? Yeah. Could be. I mean, because... I don't know how to make sense out of it. I don't know. I don't think we work through Amazon, really.
Right.
So I don't know whether they're going to, how it all works. I don't have a strong opinion.
I have to tell you, I appreciate your candor and your willingness to say I don't know, because not many leaders do, because they think it's a sign of weakness. I think it's a sign of strength to say I don't know.
I'm just one person. I can't know all these things, you know.
Up next, how has the U.S.-China trade war affected the brand's business? I ask her.
I'd like to talk a little bit about China, because you manufacture a number of your items in China.
Yes, we do.
What has the trade war meant for you guys?
The trade war has been tough for us, yeah. And, we have been looking at and reconsidering our positioning in China, which makes me sad, you know, because we have been in China, and we've done a lot of good work in China.
You mean you're thinking of pulling out?
We're not going to fully pull out, but we have pulled out some of our... It's sort of been a synchronistic thing, because some of our factories have closed, In part because there's other opportunities in China and not everyone's having to work in the factories the way
That's
they did,
true.
Which
rising
is actually
middle class,
a good
which
thing,
is good for them.
You know, so it's sort of a synchronicity of events. And so we are partially pulling out. Some of it is the tariffs is related to that, and some of it is just some of our factories, you know, have shifted. So it's a shifting thing, and, you know.
Do you have a sense of what it has cost the company?
What it's cost us?
Yeah, the tariffs. Even a percent?
It's definitely costing us. I can't tell you that exactly. I think it's really just starting to hit us because I think the ones that are affecting us are just coming into play right about now. So we'll see the results more next year.
I believe you've spent time going to China over the years.
Yes.
Going in your factories.
Yes.
Obviously concerns about human trafficking,
yes.
et cetera.
Yes.
But I'd like to ask you about human rights concerns in
yes.
China right now.
Yes.
The jailing of, you know, a million Muslim ethnic minorities, the Uyghur population there.
Yes.
As someone who has based so much of her business on ethics and morality.
Yeah. yeah.
How do you wrestle with that?
Yeah.
And have you thought about pulling out of China because of the actions of the Chinese government?
Actually, we stay because we feel like we can make a difference by being there. You know, to pull out as a protest, I can understand that and respect people who do that. We see that we have made inch-by-inch progress in terms of supporting the workers in the factories where we are over the years that we've been in China. Mm. So we see it as, you know, always working toward inching everything forward towards progress and towards world peace, towards things being better, towards better rights.
You think it would hurt the population more for you guys to exit?
I do. I think we make a difference being there. I think the people prefer to work in the factories, you know, where we are, where the Americans are monitoring and supervising and working to guarantee the rights of people there. So I think we're good. We're a good influence, and we move things forward.
Yeah. Tech companies face this issue
yeah.
more of working with the Chinese government.
Yeah, we don't. Yeah.
You don't?
No, we work independently.
Would you at this point?
I can't say that. I don't have a strong opinion. I haven't studied. I haven't thought about it.
And the protest now 6 months in
yeah.
Hong Kong.
Yeah.
As you watch that as an American citizen, but also yeah. someone who, you know, manufactures in that country, what do you think?
Very sad. You know, again, you know, we always are working. We've worked with Hong Kong, and Hong Kong has been our entry point into China. And the way Hong Kong has worked with China for so many years has been really inch by inch opening, moving forward, and it's been such a good thing. So to me, it makes me sad to see a sense of a reversal of some of those policies and that progress. And, you know, we're just about how can we, you know, keep things moving forward.
All right, let's end on a little personal, a little bit of motherhood.
Okay.
And also, before we move on to that, I did have a thought about what do you make of renting fashion?
Yeah, yeah.
Are you part of that? Does it hurt the business? Could it help the business?
No, I think it's good for certain things. You know, I think for, you know, maybe occasion kind of dressing, I think that there's meaning to that when people buy an outfit just for one event. Personally, I prefer to buy the thing I'm going to live in and love, like I was talking about, that perfect black cashmere sweater or, you know, that, you know, just that new turtleneck that I just love, I've just got to have, you know, that one I prefer, and I just wear the same thing day after day after
yeah.
day. So I don't really care about renting or, you know, personally, in terms of my daily clothes or what I think we're trying to do, I don't think it exactly fits well, but I think it's a good idea for certain kinds of companies.
Okay, back to sort of the beginning of where we started, but instead of your parents, you as a parent.
Yes.
You have struggled like I do and
yeah.
we all do with
yeah.
mom guilt.
Oh God, it's endless, isn't it?
It's endless, it's true. But you did have some advice I heard you give that I'm now trying to do about when you go home.
Oh, yes.
What
is
first thing we should do?
Oh, yes. Just put everything down and be with your kids, you know, and just, you know, give them the first 20 minutes that you're home and just like ignore everything. Don't even change your clothes if you can help it, you know. Maybe if that makes you more comfortable, you can change your clothes, but I don't have to change mine because I only wear comfortable clothes. But and I think to put down the work. And that's what I didn't do when my kids were young.
You work too much.
I work too much. I would bring the reports home or, you know, study things, think about things, you know.
Do you regret it?
I do. What I try to say is be where you are, you know, like when I'm at work, I try not to worry about my kids. So sometimes I would take a call, of course, if one of them calls me and I'm at work, I take the call, you know, or if something important is happening with my kids, I always do. So
be
they're always my priority. But when at home, you know, try to, you know, stay with them and let go of the work. And that's hard. We try to do no emails on the weekends.
Oh, good.
It's really hard.
But you can do it. People wait.
Yeah. People wait.
People wait.
Know? Just make the people who are sending the emails feel guilty.
People wait.
Instead of the people who aren't responding, like Monday morning, why didn't you respond to my email? Wait a minute. Why did you send me an email on the weekend?
There you go.
You know.
Parental leave.
Oh, yes. Okay.
I suppose you didn't really get maternity leave because you were building your company, unless you gave it to yourself.
Oh, I moved my work into my home at that period. So.
Does Eileen Fisher as a company give moms and dads paid parental leave?
We do. We have a 12-week policy for the primary caregiver and 3 weeks for the non-primary caregiver.
Have you thought about upping that for the non-primary, which is often the dad, but I can tell you, as just having two babies, he was very primary in my experience.
Yes.
Have you thought about increasing that?
You know, it hasn't come up. I think we're like 80%
women.
So it's not been a fight. You know, mm-hmm. I'm sure that you know. Everything could be a discussion.
It's evolving and changing a lot in just the last few years, I've noticed in companies.
Yeah.
And then employee benefits. I remember having Jen Hyman on the podcast who started Rent the Runway. And right after she wrote this op-ed in the New York Times about how she had realized that as a company a few years ago, they were not giving their factory workers, warehouse workers, the same benefits that corporate, like headquarters employees were getting.
Right.
What are your thoughts on that? Is that are the benefits equally shared across the company?
Yes.
Because in many companies they're not.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Didn't even occur to me.
Many companies that have contractors, for example, or you know, warehouse employees would get different benefits.
So our warehouse employees and our retail employees and our corporate employees all get the same benefits. Who doesn't get the benefits are our sewing factories. They get different, you know, they're own, separately owned, so we don't control their benefits, but we work to, you know, support them in a lot of ways.
You have raised your voice on some social issues and political issues, climate change, when the U.S. pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord, abortion.
Yes.
You've spoken up about abortion rights.
Yes.
As someone who is uncomfortable speaking out and being in the spotlight, and as a leader of a company that employs people that have all different political views.
Right.
How do you think about that and when to use your voice and the brand?
Yeah. Well, I think we're actually a platform. I think it's really, really important for businesses to, you know, to speak to certain issues. It's in a different time. You would think the government would be holding those kinds of things, but it's a different time right now. So it's sort of requiring us to step up more in terms of both environment and women's rights. You know, we're a women's company. So, you know, it's like the women inside demand that we stand up for certain kinds of things. And you know, sustainability and environment is just an issue that's so deeply in our core that it's just so natural.
You say the women demand that we stand up and speak about things. Did your employees come to you and say, please use your voice.
Yes, 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 yes.
On abortion and climate change?
Well, we think of it in general as, you know, all women's rights, supporting women's choice, mm-hmm. supporting, the environment and, you know, yes, and our employees are very, they're very passionate about it. And we also try to be really careful because we, you know, respect that different people have different points of view on different things. And, you know, like with the issue of China, we don't want to be a divider. You know, we want to be a healer. We want to help. We want to bring progress and we want to bring people together. So, you know, so we're very careful in how we use our voice.
You clearly have no intention of retiring or any plan. I have read that you said
That's not totally true.
Well, the New York Times asked you about it, and you said, I will
retire. When I'm ready.
I will retire when I feel safe. What does that mean?
I know. Actually, what that means, and I've been trying to articulate that, is that I feel like I've been holding this idea that came to me that I have a responsibility for, almost like my first child, you know, and, you know, when I feel that I'm able to fully articulate this idea and that this idea is being shepherded into the future. And so mm-hmm. right now I'm working hard on what's the structure that supports this idea. You know, who are the people who will hold this idea into yes. the next generation? So that's the work I'm doing. I'm trying to step out of the center of it in that way and hold it in a bigger way. So
who is your dream woman to dress?
Oh, Michelle Obama.
Have you?
No.
Well, you should write her a letter.
Yeah. Or, you know what? I also think that I dress every woman. It's something very, like, ordinary or something to me, too. So I don't have big dreams of celebrities, to tell you the truth. I mean, Michelle Obama blows my mind, but she's amazing.
You should write her a letter.
Yeah.
You never know.
Yeah.
Who is your hero?
My hero. Well, we have Ruth Bader Ginsburg. We have... you know, I was impressed with Hillary. I'm still struggle, Hillary Clinton and all of that, sad. My hero, Michelle Obama's a hero. Let's see.
Those are three.
Big heroes. They're good heroes, yeah.
Legacy, do you think about it?
Yeah, well, do I think about it? Yeah. I don't know. I hope that this company, you know, stands for good and can keep that good things, all the good that we're doing, trying to move on in the world.
And even though it bears your name, outlive
the name. Outlive even the name. I don't care about the name. I never even wanted it to be called Eileen.
Really?
Fisher. I just want the concept and the idea. To live on.
One thing I ask almost everyone we have on at the end is this. What do you want your children to say about you one day?
Oh, you know, my daughter said, I gave a little talk the other day, and my daughter said, Mom, you were competent and wise. I was like, I practically started crying because I never think of myself as confident. And wise, well, that's, to hear her say that, I was like, wow, I didn't have to wait till I died to have her say that. So I'm like, oh, God, that's very touching.
Eileen Fisher, thank you. It's a pleasure to get to meet you after all these years.
Oh, thank you.
I really appreciate it.
That was my pleasure.
Thank you
totally.
So much.
Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of Boss Files. I would love to hear your thoughts on this week's episode and people you want to hear from. So leave a review and follow me on social media at Poppy Harlow CNN.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.